You're listening to Catch the Current, the coolest seafood podcast out there from the team at Undercurrent News, your trusted source for seafood prices, news, and data. I'm Amanda Buckle.
And I'm Lauren Castiglione. Well, the plan wasn't to talk about U.S. President Donald Trump and his tariffs in this week's episode, but surprise, surprise, here we are. So on Wednesday evening, the U.S. Court of International Trade, in response to two separate cases filed by businesses and U.S. states impacted by the tariffs, declared that the president lacked the authority to impose tariffs under the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA.
So, what does that mean?
Well, tell me, please. And quickly.
My understanding is that the court's order halts the 10% Liberation Day tariffs that Trump put in place last month, and it also halts the order on the 30% tariff placed on China and the 25% tariffs on Canada and Mexico, which, as Undercurrent has been reporting, some of these tariffs have been postponed or already reduced by subsequent declarations from the president. So all that information is up to date on our website. I'm not even going to try to give that to you in podcast form here.
What this ruling from the court doesn't impact are the tariffs that were set under Section 232 or Section 301 of the Trade Expansion Act, which includes some tariffs on Chinese seafood. The court gave the White House up to 10 days to unwind the tariffs impacted by its decision, but a White House spokesperson told the New York Times that it plans to file an appeal. The spokesperson said it is not for unelected judges to decide how to properly address a national emergency, adding that Mr. Trump would use every lever of executive power to address this crisis.
Spoiler alert, things have already changed since we recorded this podcast. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit has paused a ruling that nullified most tariffs imposed earlier this year by U.S. President Donald Trump. This all happened Thursday, May 29th in the afternoon. The court granted the Trump administration's request to temporarily pause a ruling issued May 28th by the U.S. Court of International Trade. So stick to undercurrentnews.com for all the latest information, because I cannot update this podcast again before we publish it.
Now we're excited to welcome UCN's Dan Gibson, fresh off a flight from Iceland's capital, where he was reporting live from the third annual Icelandic Aquaculture and Oceans Forum. The 2-day event, which is hosted by Arion Bank, was created to represent the growing aquaculture sector in Iceland, including sea-based and land-based farms. So Dan, you had some pretty interesting headlines in the blog this week. One of them was that Canadian processor Highliner sees big future prospects for Icelandic seafood in the US. What else can you tell us from the event?
So, I mean, yeah, it was surprisingly, first of all, that there were some really, really big names there. And this is the third year they've been running it. And aquaculture is not a huge industry in Iceland, but it is growing. And you can see how seriously they took it by some of the people who were there. There was the CEO of Skretting, Bastian van Tilburg, who was, of course, the CEO, as you mentioned there, of Highliner, Paul Dewar. Highliner has made no secret that they are looking to gain access to raw material in Europe, and especially in Norway. They've made investments in Norcod, cod farmer, and in Andfjord Salmon, the land-based flow-through farmer up there. So to see him in Iceland, he again makes no secret that they want to make more investments in to gain stakes in these resources. And when you think about it, it makes a lot of sense, because Iceland right now only produces 50,000 tons of salmon a year. So perspective, Norway harvests 1.5 million metric tons a year. So Iceland is just a drop in the ocean. But they have big, big plans for land-based salmon farming, especially in the south of the country. And in total, they've got five huge projects there. We're talking over 3 billion euros of capex will be required to build them. And then when they're finished, the idea is you're looking at about 170,000 tons of production. And the thing, of course, is that Iceland does not have particularly big processing facilities for salmon, because it's quite a new species, for a new sector for it. So you can imagine that Paul Dewar and Highliner is very interested in helping to take some of that burden off their hands, especially if these plans come to fruition and they're going to be seeing so much raw material coming online. I was taken on a tour, actually, of First Water, who are one of the largest of these upcoming projects. They've already, I think, been funded with around about 250 million euros. And their plan is to grow and to build a farm that would produce 50,000 tons itself in this one plot of land on the south of the country. So you're basically talking all of Iceland's current production of salmon, repeated again at just one site on the south coast there, and you could see that the building work was going on. You could see the
So they were in
they
the middle of
already
the
had,
construction, is what you were able to say? Okay, wow.
yeah. So they're at this point where they are just piecing it together, really. They've got, I think, the first phase is one they've been working through, and they've got a design that means that they can add almost like batches of tanks online at a time, rather than, say, for instance, something like Atlantic Sapphire down in Florida that sort of built a one big huge unit and now has to follow that with another, big huge unit that's going to take several years. And each of these Icelandic operations, they're talking about adding 4,000, 5,000 tons of capacity each year. And then I guess from there, it will be a question of how fast they can utilize that capacity, as well as the question of what kind, will it be profitable? That's the other thing. Because I should make clear here, unlike Atlantic Sapphire, these land-based operations, they're not recirculating aquaculture systems. They are hybrid flow-through. So whereas with a RAS system, you're talking complete 100%. The water goes in, it stays in the flow, and very little of it is ever replaced. With a hybrid flow-through system, only about 30 to 70% of it is recycled. The rest is sort of new water being pumped up from underground. And they've demonstrated that it works as a form for growing salmon. There's a company, Salmon Evolution, in Norway. They produced close to 5,000 tons last year. So they demonstrate that it does work, and you can successfully grow salmon with very low mortalities. The problem, of course, is that it is capital intensive, as I mentioned there. Huge sums of money are needed to build these facilities, and so for them, a high salmon price is not it's not so much something they'd like as it is a necessity in order to make the whole project economically viable and to get a good return on investment for the people who have, invested in it. So that was, of course, one of the big topics of conversation was this year. Salmon prices have surprisingly, tanked. They're about half of where they were at the same time last year, and so there were investors asking and sort of finding out, like, what's the prospect for the future? Because the salmon industry has thrived basically on having this gap between supply and demand, where they have constant shortage of supply versus demand, but this year demand just isn't there. So obviously they're very hopeful it comes back. The other question, of course, is from Iceland's point of view, they're right next door to the biggest growing salmon market in the world, in the US. And when you consider the volumes that the US currently takes in, they're taking in 200,000 tons of salmon annually from Chile. So you can see 175,000 tons, if this comes to fruition, coming out of Iceland. Where's that going to go? It's very obvious that Canada and the US is the clear number one destination, since demand doesn't really change in Europe, and China and the Far East, the Norwegians have that locked up. So it does seem like that they are going to be very dependent on there being the demand they need from North America. And so to come back to the start there, to have Highliner present and taking an interest is, of course, that's a really promising sign for them.
And Dan's full blog, I was reading through it. Dan, I can't even believe it was 2 days, and it's like a novel of how much content you were able to wrap up from there. That's like, it's truly amazing. So definitely check out that blog post if you have not done so already. So with farmed salmon covered, also joining us on the pod today to talk about wild salmon is UCN's Jacob Resnick. So Jacob, what's going on with Alaska's wild fisheries right now? Because your latest article just came out and Copper River is temporarily not fishing right now. Is that correct?
They're just taking a little break. So we're really early. I mean, really early in what would be the Alaska salmon harvest. Copper River kind of heralds the official opening of the wild salmon season. It opened May 22nd. They have kind of limiting fishing opportunities. They usually fish twice a week for these 12-hour openings. And there's been a really, really excellent forecast of nearly 2 million sockeye salmon projected for 2025. Now, to put that in context, we had about 1.37 million harvested commercially last year, which exceeded the forecast by the state managers. So there's a lot of optimism right now. They've run two openers so far. The fish have not been showing up yet. The numbers were a little lackluster for sockeye, down from what they had this time last year. But the concern was the Chinook, the king salmon, which there's a lot of scrutiny on for conservation. That run has the managers are becoming weak, and so they've called for conservative management. So what they do and what they've done, they announced just the other day, is they're going to shut down the anticipated They were supposed to be fishing or expected to be fishing on Thursday, May 29th, and they're taking a break and they're going to reassess over the weekend to see how much escapement has come through. And there's hope that they'll resume fishing next week.
Now, is this something that happens every year or?
This is something that can happen anytime you have dynamic fishing management, like Alaska Department of Fish and Game, because you got to remember they measure the escapement, which is the fish that swim, that are not captured by the fleet, that get up into fresh water to spawn for, future seasons. They have to make sure they get that escapement, because if they don't, they won't have runs in the future. So the biologists, they manage, every couple of days they open and close the fishery to make sure they get that escapement. And so this is something that definitely can happen. It's not doom and gloom. Sometimes the run shows up late, but the reason there's, a lot of scrutiny on this, because it's a very hyper marketed niche product. Copper River salmon, it's a delicacy known the world over. It's also the first sockeye, wild king salmon from Alaska that hits the market, because it's the first fishery, and so it fetches a high price there too. So there's hoping that the run will pick up, but yeah, they're just taking a little breather right now.
And of course, that's not the only drama that's going on up in Alaska right now. And as someone with an entertainment journalism background, I live for the drama. So I have been just living for your coverage of Northline's Hannah. So can you talk about what, just give
Yeah,
a brief recap there and
yeah,
what's
so
the
we'll switch
latest?
over to Bristol Bay, which is, the largest wild sockeye fishery probably in the world, and that doesn't get going until the end of June, and really usually peaks around July, 4th of July, July 4th holiday. There's been a lot of, as our listeners know, a lot of consolidation in the processing side, with Silver Bay Seafoods taking a stake in OBI Seafoods. So we're down to, like, I think just four major players buying fish on Bristol Bay, this huge fishery. And so there's a lot of concern, because Northline Seafoods, one of the four, they have this flagship freezer barge that they built in 2023, and last year was its first season, which they run up to the Nooshigak district. It anchors off in Clark's Point, and it takes in fish. And a lot of the work that was done to make this vessel into this floating seafood platform, a lot of the vendors still haven't been paid. So we covered that earlier in the year out of these lien holders. Well, the plot thickened when one of the lien holders, a welding contractor, he actually filed in federal court under maritime law, asking for U.S. authorities to seize the vessel over non-payment. And the judge went as far as signing a warrant allowing the vessel to be seized over this. It didn't quite happen. In the 11th hour, it looks like Northline Seafoods was able to secure a bond as alternative collateral.
It was a real nail biter there.
Yeah, because if the problem was, if the vessel was seized, or the litigation had, there had been like an injunction, precluding them from leaving their port in Bellingham, Washington, and going up and not being in Alaska in time, this could have taken out a major, one of the four major players, and really just shooken up the whole, salmon buying scene up in Bristol Bay. I have been tracking the vessel. It departed last weekend, and it is now in Chatham Strait in southeast Alaska. Looks like it's a little east of Baranof Island, just south of Sitka.
Sticking with the US West Coast for a moment, I had the opportunity to talk with American Seafood's Chief Sustainability Officer Tim Fitzgerald and At Sea Processors Association Vice President Caitlin Yeager while they were at Pier 91 in Seattle, Washington for Net Recycling Day, an event that united the Alaska pollock industry, including the At Sea Processors Association's five member companies: American Seafoods, Arctic Storm Management Group, Coastal Villages Region Fund, Glacier Fish Company, and Trident Seafoods. Take a listen. I know American Seafoods has been doing this for years now, but what brought about this collaborative effort across all the At Sea Processors Association members this year?
We were in the early stages of planning for this year's event, and Sarah Nayani from Arctic Storm had heard about the event previously and was interested in learning more and wanted to see how Arctic could get involved. And then once that happened, it all kind of snowballed, and we reached out to the other three member companies, and everyone was super excited to partner and really make this an industry-wide thing as opposed to just one of the single companies. And we've gotten great participation from all the companies, and literally as we speak, they're out hacking up nets across about an acre of Terminal 91 at the Port of Seattle.
As Tim mentioned, American's been running this event for a couple years, and APA's been really focused on gear development and innovation and research lately. So when the time arose for this to come up again, all of the members expressed interest, and largely because it presents an opportunity where we have a lot of other mission critical staff have the chance to work with the gear, work with the fishermen, and increase their knowledge base about how each part functions and what it serves. So I think not only is it the recycling aspect that we look forward to, but it kind of builds solidarity amongst the companies and our vendors. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I enjoy working in the fishing industry is kind of the vibrant maritime community. And I think this is a great chance to get everyone together and learn a little more about what we do.
Safety first, then teamwork. It's one of my favorite phrases. So you guys got your safety first. So volunteers, they're cutting, they're sorting, they're preparing 4 retired fishing nets for recycling. I know these are big vessels, so these got to be some big nets. I know you said across like an acre.
We're doing a competition. Everyone guessed how many pounds or tons of plastic we would recycle throughout the course of the day, and we'll have hopefully a tally at the end of the day. But we're hoping for between 75 and 100,000 pounds of plastics that get recycled as a result of this event.
And what have you guys done in the past?
The first year that American did this, we only did one net with 20 volunteers, and it was about 20,000 pounds. We went from one net to 2 nets to now 4 nets, and on average, it depends on which type of net we're recycling, but they're about 20,000 pounds of plastic each, and then we'll also be recycling the chain and the cable as scrap metal. That'll even be on top of the plastic tally.
How long do fishing nets usually last?
Different components of the gear have different lifetimes. For instance, a cod end experiences a lot more wear and tear than a net or a bridle or kind of the mid-body section. One area that we're particularly concerned with, for instance, is what they call like an extended, like a packing tube section, because that area is where our salmon excluders lie. So for instance, if that's not flowing properly or becomes stretched out with time goes on, the salmon excluders lose their efficacy. So another kind of benefit of going through and kind of Marie Kondo, make way, get rid of the old and make way for the new, is that it gives us the ability to employ the newer technology and some of the improved methods that we're constantly searching to find.
As Caitlin said, the material technology and the construction technology of the nets definitely changes over time, and the older nets don't perform the same way that the newer nets do. And I would say on average, we're probably retiring 1 or 2 nets per vessel per year.
We touched briefly on salmon excluders. I mean, there are a number of trade-offs to consider with gear improvement. It's not just about efficiency, it's also reduction in bycatch and making sure that we're operating in a responsible way. Sort of as Tim had mentioned, recycling the gear is a complex process, and accumulation of marine debris in communities is something we're very concerned about. So I like that we're expanding the pool of people who understand what to do with this and how to dispose of it. Hopefully those lessons can be parlayed into not just the pollock fishery, but other sectors as well. And then back towards the gear innovation, we're testing new technology like live feed cameras, using those in novel ways. We're looking at different types of sensors to model how the gear flies through the water to better inform not only how we fish, but to work into the scientific process and going about it in a really standardized and a systematic way. That way, not only are we better informing the pollock fishery and our Alaska fisheries management, but those tools can be used in other fisheries global, since this is just an increasing concern that we're facing.
I think we need to get out there for next year's event. But moving along, let's talk markets. So the news this week in scallops is a surge in domestic landings out of Nantucket Lightship West area, where harvesters are reporting catch rates up to 4,000 pounds per day, which is triple the pace seen this time last year. With reports of over 100 boats active in the area, landings at New Bedford's base auction hit a season high of over 500,000 pounds last week, fueling renewed optimism that the 2025 season could exceed the projected 18 million pound total, which would be very, very welcomed. This unexpected supply bump is putting real pressure on prices, Wholesale values for larger sizes like U10 and U12s dropped by 15 to 18% in just 1 week, and auction prices are now at their lowest point of the season. Still, quality has improved from earlier concerns linked to early spawning, particularly in George's Bank and the Channel, which is helping maintain steady market flow. As landings continue and pricing adjusts, the industry will be watching closely to see whether strong supply is matched by summer demand or if we're heading into a prolonged period of downward pricing pressure. In salmon, the Chilean salmon market continues to trend lower this week, with fresh fillet average values dropping by 15 to 20 cents per pound across core sizes. This reflects a broader seasonal softening as supply normalizes following earlier disruptions tied to Chile's national holiday last week and brief labor-related delays. What is notable is a growing shift in strategy among some producers. They're choosing to freeze product rather than harvest into a soft fresh market. This move is aimed at easing the downward pressure on fresh pricing, which continues to face headwinds from some cautious consumers, high retail prices, and slower post-Mother's Day demand. On the frozen side, however, fillets are now becoming more available after earlier tightness. Portions, particularly 6 to 8 ounce sizes, remain tight and steady, with some suppliers booked out until late Q3. So, looking ahead here, market players expect continued pressure as supply builds seasonally in Q3, while demand shows little signs of picking up. It's shaping up to be a challenging summer across the salmon markets.
As promised last week, joining us to talk about the crab market is UCN's price analyst, Gary Morrison.
It's sad to report that I didn't go to any parties with snow crab on the menu this Memorial Day weekend. So maybe next year, as we talked about, right? But in the U.S. wholesale market, prices have kind of stabilized here this week. What we're seeing is Norway and the Gulf of St. Lawrence, they're pretty much ended their season. So they're working through the inventory that they have. It's really Newfoundland and the Labrador region, which is roughly about 50% landed, that is really supplying the market now. When we're talking about Canada's largest snow crab, it's mostly 5 to 8 and 8 to 10 ounce clusters. So that's providing some opportunity for people to price shop for those sizes. But the larger sizes, they have a positive bias because they're really limited this year. So they're waiting to see if they can get some of those larger ones. But overall, demand still remains really good at these prices. And where people can shift origins, they are. Where there's limited inventory on Gulf and Norway, there's also a little full steadiness to the market and a little bit less willingness by sellers to discount product.
Okay, now before we go, Lauren, let me quickly set the stage for you for our final story.
Ooh.
Yet another new Catch the Current podcast segment I am calling WTF, What the Fish? So,
Love it.
Lauren, pretend you and I are in beautiful sunny Florida, okay?
Okay.
We've hired a commercial fishing boat captain to take us out on the water so we can try our hand at catching red snapper.
Love it. I'm assuming we've already taken out our Dramamine.
Of course, we can't even be on a docked boat without it. But the fish are biting. We're having a great day. Oh, hey, look, there's dolphins.
Oh, I love dolphins.
And then, bam, our fishing boat captain takes out a 12-gauge shotgun and starts firing at the dolphins as surface near our vessel. Children scream.
I'm screaming. Wait, and also, we've got kids on board? Amanda, WTF.
Yes, exactly. The perfect story to kick off our WTF, What the Fish segment, where we highlight a news story that was so whack that we need to talk about it. Zachary Barfield, a commercial fisherman and licensed charter fishing captain in Panama City, Florida, has been sentenced to prison for killing dolphins. So, according to a press release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Florida, Barfield poisoned and shot bottlenose dolphins on multiple occasions in the Gulf of Mexico between 2022 and 2023.
No,
So,
seriously, WTF.
yeah, it's insane.
I like that you also keep these stories hidden from me so that I can have an actual reaction here, but this is an aptly named segment.
Yeah, so this guy, he put this pesticide into bait fish. So NOAA estimates that he poisoned up to 70 dolphins, likely resulting in multiple dolphin deaths, but they don't know. And then their investigation also found that he shot at least 5 dolphins with a 12-gauge shotgun, with one confirmed death. And he reportedly used this gun to shoot dolphins near his vessel, including shooting a dolphin in front of 2 elementary school-aged children.
OMG.
What a
This is
traumatizing
ridiculous.
experience. So this is the worst part, though. You'll never guess his sentence.
Oh, it gets worse.
He was only sentenced to 30 days in prison and fined $51,000 for violating the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, or Rodenticide Act. I mean, this was happened all, well, some of it happened while he was on a charter fishing boat, but he's also a commercial fisherman.
You would think he would capitalize on, hey, come fishing with us and come
See
see the
some
dolphins,
dolphins.
but no.
They'll eat your red snapper right off the line.
Oh,
So anyway,
gosh.
wow. WTF. What the fish, right?
Yeah, way to end the podcast, Amanda. We can always count on
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you back here next week.
Bye-bye.